studio. This is Guy. All right. Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. Today's song comes from regular contributor Afrozen, who wrote the usual theme song for this show for me and my work. You just heard E-Race, the B-side of Nature Bats Last. This September 5th, 2015 edition, episode 109 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from San Antonio Village in the Cayo District of the Central American country of Belize. This is Guy McPherson, creator and founder of the show, and I'm joined today by friends. Specifically, I welcome the sometime co-host and sometime guest host of the radio show, this radio show, my co-author and partner, Pauline Panayotu Schneider. We are joined by three guests here in the outdoor studio known as the Maya Mountains of Belize, longtime friend and occasional guest of the show, the thoughtful wanderer Paul Marcotte joins us, along with new friends Sarah Law and Glenn Osborne, who made the trip to Central America from Eastern Canada and Western Mexico, respectively. Finally, we are joined by the third-time guest of the show and personal friend, Radical Dar Jamail. Dar is calling from his home in the northwest corner of Washington State. I've been threatening or promising, depending upon one's perspective, to retire from the NTHE scene and follow my own message. I'm becoming increasingly serious about doing so, despite ongoing attempts of the trolls in the deep state to keep me engaged and embattled. So, with actual retirement as my goal, I will be hosting this show today for the final time. I doubt this will mark my final appearance on the show, if the system holds. I'll be handing the reins of the show to my real friend, Kiwi Kevin Hester, effective with next month's show, to air on October 3rd, 2017. The show will air monthly, at least at the beginning, as it has for more than a year, and I will join Kevin as co-host or guest when the opportunity arises. As my public presence winds down, huge thanks to everybody who's contributed to this show. I've enjoyed thoughtful guests and wonderful listeners since the show launched on August 6th, 2014, more than 3 years ago. I'm confident Kevin will continue the tradition of the People Radio with thoughtful guests, listeners, and callers. We are taking your calls on today's show for us and for our guests. First, we'll chat with our guests for a bit and then prepare to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Let's start with a thoughtful wanderer, Paul Marcotte. You first joined this show as a guest for our second episode way back on August 13th, 2014. You are here in San Antonio Village for the second time after a three-day delay courtesy of Hurricane Harvey. You visited me at the Mud Hut in New Mexico on seven separate occasions. What brings you here this week to Belize for the second time to make a visit?
Thank you, Guy and Pauline, and our friends here as well, for having me come down and spend time with you. You know, it was a very easy decision to make. Things have just speeded up in an enormous way with regards to what's happening with the climate. And I don't think, and I haven't thought for quite some time, that any of us are going to be around too much longer. And I couldn't think of people that I'd rather spend some time with prior to everything going to hell soon. So, and in light of, you know, the trip down, we already got canceled in Houston coming down. So the trip is shorter than I had expected. And now with Irma and Jose trundling along in the ocean, it looks like we may not even get out of here. So I'm happy to be here. Thank you for being my dear friends. And it's going to be an interesting next few days. Let's say that.
Could be this is the end, just like Afrozen sang to us moments ago.
Could be.
It seemed rather short.
Thank you for that, Paul. Sarah Law, we first met in Friday at the airport after becoming friends online several months ago. You're a web designer and farm sitter. What compelled you to make the long trip from Eastern Canada, interrupted with an unexpected 24-hour stay in Atlanta, again, courtesy of Hurricane Harvey?
I'm assuming you want the short version, right?
Whatever.
Well, like you, I travel all the time just to see as much as I possibly can while I still can. And I had a two-week window, and you were in Belize, and I've never been to Belize, and I would rather want to, like, come and visit you and see you in person before I die, preferably. So that's why I'm here.
That's great. We don't want to see you after we're dead, that's for sure. We'll be a little busy with other things that being turned into compost and so on. Glenn Osborne, as with Paul and Sarah, you're originally from Canada. I find myself surrounded today by people who add extra U's and S's into their words. You arrived in Belize Sunday from your home in Mexico. In a short bit, what's the story behind your adventurous trip here by way of Guatemala?
Well, thanks for letting me join you here in Belize, Guy. I'm honored. Well, I decided to come to Belize to attend the last Nature Bats Last radio program episode hosted by yourself, Dr. Guy McPherson, and to personally thank him for his honesty and clarity in presenting the situation as it pertains to abrupt climate change. I offer up my sincere gratitude to Guy for stepping up to the plate and not faltering under the ensuing duress that comes with presenting the truth. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Glenn. We are joined today via telecommunications by renowned radical journalist Darja Mayo. In late 2003, weary of the overall failure of the United States media to accurately report on the realities of the military misadventures in Iraq for the Iraqi people, Darja Mayo went to the Middle East to report on those misadventures himself. Dar also has reported from Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan. His work is now focusing on anthropogenic climate disruption and the environment. Dar's stories have been published by Truthout, Interpress Service, Tom Dispatch, The Sunday Herald and Scott Guardian, Foreign Policy and Focus, Le Monde Diplomatique, The Huffington Post, The Nation, The Independent, Al Jazeera, among others. Dar's writing has been translated into French, Polish, German, Dutch, Spanish, Japanese, Portuguese, Chinese, Arabic, and Turkish. On radio as well as on television, Dar has reported for Democracy Now! And Al Jazeera, and has appeared on the BBC, NPR, and numerous other stations around the globe. Dar's honest investigative reporting has earned him numerous awards, including the 2008 Martha Gellhorn Award for Journalism, the Lannan Foundation Writing Residency Fellowship, the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism, the Joe A. Calloway Award for Civic Courage, and 4 Project Censored Awards. You can follow his work at darjamail.net. That's darjamail.net. That's an impressive bio, Dar. Thanks for honoring us with your presence today on Nature Bats Last.
Well, thank you, Guy. It's a body of work, but you know, all of that really, I think now is largely irrelevant in the scope of what is upon us. So I think in relation to you know, what's happening to the planet, that you know, everything else is cataclysmic as the occupation of Iraq was and continues to be for that country. You know, everything now pales in comparison to what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, you know, it's quite fitting that you join me in conversation as my public presence winds down. You first interviewed me about the topic of abrupt climate change during late 2013. Nearly 4 years later, as the evidence continues to accumulate, neither of us seem so crazy as we used to. And as with me, I'm certain you don't want to be right about the direction this is headed, but you're just connecting the evidence here. Can you tell us about your journey so far along the path to abrupt climate change, hurricanes and all?
Well, coming across your essay where you connected all the dots years ago, and I came across it probably about 2-3 months before I interviewed you for that piece I wrote for Tom Dispatch, Are We Already Off the Climate Precipice?, which we published in December of 2013. And when I came across your essay of connecting all the dots, hyperlinking to every single scientific report that you cite, it took me several weeks. I was living in Doha, Qatar, working for Al Jazeera English, and I read that, and I went into kind of a deep depression, and it took me a long time to incorporate all of that information and data, and even more so what it means, you know, reading all of that in one go and connecting all the dots as you did, and then kind of going through my own process of connecting those dots in my own way so I could take it in of what that really means existentially, was extremely challenging. And writing that article I did, which featured your voice and several other people that I interviewed for it as well, talking along those same lines that, look, we're off the cliff, and it's not, are we going to mitigate this? Are we going to, can we change it, et cetera, et cetera. It's brace for impact. And then even more recently, it's how do we want to use the time that we have right now? And so that was really I'd been following climate disruption for a long time. I'd seen so much of it firsthand, living in Alaska from 1996 for 10 years, doing a lot of mountaineering and seeing the glaciers receding with my own eyes every single year and other dramatic signs. But then, you know, that piece that I did where I interviewed you, Guy, and then all of my subsequent reporting since then has only gone on to confirm what you were talking about then. And now I'm working on a book called The End of Ice that the New Press is going to publish next year. And I've done extensive travel around the world working on the book, from the Great Barrier Reef to St. Paul Island and the Pribilofs to the heights of Denali to Barrow, Alaska, to many, many other places in between. South Florida for sea level rise, which is interesting that I was just there earlier this summer, given a Category 5 hurricane headed that way as we speak. So all of these field trips have basically led me to the fact that I write a monthly climate disruption dispatch for Truthout. And when anyone reads those, they're always very apocalyptic, just like your work, Guy. When you put all this information in one place, it really gives people a clear picture of how far along we already are. But when I've gone into the field to do interviews with experts in all of these locations, what I'm finding is that things are even far worse than I thought. And I don't know if that's a product of just seeing it with my own eyes. It's partially that, perhaps, but I think it is that going out on the front lines, things are happening so quickly that it is worse than I read, because what I read is now outdated. I mean, it's almost like the climate is changing as fast as technology, right? That old joke, well, if you buy a piece of technology, it's going to be outdated in 6 months. I think that same kind of idea applies to what we're seeing with the climate, but in a lot of ways, even faster.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, every time I turn around, things are happening faster than expected. I've even written an essay called Faster Than Expected. And after hearing me speak, there was a woman in Washington State who created the blog Faster Than Expected at fasterthanexpected.com. That's all she does, is she includes links and articles about things on the climate front proceeding faster than expected. Now, you mentioned early on in your response here the issue of how you want to use the time we have. So let's start off with a personal question. How do you want to use the time we have? I know you're an avid outdoorsman and have been since your college days from Texas A&M University and then moving to Alaska. Are you going to continue along that front? What do you have in mind? How are you going to spend the time you have left?
I absolutely am. Every weekend off work, I live right nearby Olympic National Park, and I spend as much time out there as I can. And I really, for example, I just did over the long weekend a long backpacking trip to a place called Anderson Pass in the Olympics. And I hiked up to about 5,500 feet to the glacial moraine of Anderson Glacier, which sits right at the base of Mount Anderson. It's the 10th highest peak in the park. And there's no more glacier there. So you're up on top of this giant moraine of this old glacial basin, clearly carved out by the basin. And there's a couple of snow fields because we had a heavy snow year this winter. There's the big aqua turquoise glacial lake, and there's no more glacier. And the way I look at it, and then I'm up there, and then as I'm looking west, you can see smoke coming up into Puget Sound from wildfires in Oregon, from wildfires over in eastern Washington and Montana. You can see this giant brown soot cloud coming up into the area. And then there I am standing basically at the foot of what used to be a pretty sizable glacier in the Olympic Mountains. And it's really I look at it and I got this wordage from you, Guy, of like, we're in a hospice situation with the planet. And if for any of us who's ever sat with someone that we love and care about who's very, very sick, possibly terminal or definitely terminal, when you sit in that situation with them, you don't want to blink. You know, you want to remember every moment. You want to be there completely present, and you want to remember that time. And I feel like now when I go up into the mountains, that's my way of doing that with the planet.
That's awesome. And you have had some wonderful experiences in the course of writing your book, your forthcoming book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about those? What's the best anecdote you can come up with from your recent travels? Something that's going away, something that's clearly been altered besides the glaciers that are going away, obviously. Maybe in a conversation you had with somebody. What can you tell us about your recent work that might or might not appear in the book?
Well, it's, you know, gosh, there's been so many of those every place I've gone. I mean, it's been a really deeply profound experience. And I knew how far along we were before I started all of these book trips. But now that I'm on the back end of them, and I'm going to spend all fall just sitting in my office getting this manuscript pulled together and finalizing it, it's even more profound when I look at it, when I pull it all together. And so I guess when you ask that question, one of them that comes to mind was going out to the Great Barrier Reef in early March, and I was going out there with a marine scientist named Dean Miller. And I interviewed him on the boat on the way out. It's about an hour and a half boat ride from Port Douglas out to the outer reef where we started our day. And we had a really profound interview. And he says he's Australian. He's completely in love with the reef. It's why he's a marine scientist. And he said, look, things are happening so fast here now. And we're going out there at the very beginning of the second mass coral bleaching event in as many years of the Great Barrier Reef. And at the end of that event this year, between the two events, 90% of the reef had bleached out. And he said, look, I'm no longer doing science. And he points to, he has a really nice underwater camera sitting beside us with a giant fisheye lens on it. And he says, I am now using my camera. That's my tool, because I feel like right now we're just in a place where people need to see what's going on, and there's not enough funding and not enough scientists coming out here to actually watch what's happening to the reef, which we are losing. And he said, so my camera is my main tool. People just need to see this. And he said, you know, and then he got really personal and said, you know, for my kids, you know, I'm taking them out here to show them this too, because I want them to see it and have this memory and be able to say that they've seen the Great Barrier Reef, because it's not going to be here when they get older.
That's a great story. You know, the scientist with the camera who claims he's no longer doing science reminds me of the way I taught my courses at the University of Arizona for years, requiring all the students in my science courses to prepare a significant piece of art or literature as a major part of their grade. So this brings up the question, if the scientist has turned camera operator to document the demise of the living planet, what are you? Are you a scientist? Are you an artist? Are you some combination of them? And what are other journalists?
That's a really good question, Guy. I know for sure I can only give you a partial answer today, and that's certainly a good seed for me to let set in there and see what comes from it in the coming days and weeks and next couple of months while I work on this book. But I've approached the climate situation now similar to how I approach my role reporting in Iraq. And Robert Fisk, he's a renowned war reporter for The Independent. He's written multiple books. And when I first started journalism, he was one of my heroes, because he really wrote authentically and honestly about, you know, Western nefarious policies across the Middle East over the decades. And he'd just been in one war after another. And he writes in a foreword to his book, Pity the Nation, which is a long tome he wrote about the civil war and ongoing crisis in Lebanon. at one point in the foreword, he said, you know, people ask me, why do I keep doing this work? Because it doesn't change anything. And it's just one giant crisis after another. And things consistently just keep getting worse. And he said, you know, I write so that at the end of the day, when history is being written, people will not be able to say, no one told us that this was happening. And so just for history, and I guess for me, especially when I write my dispatches every month, which are horribly depressing to write, and then parts of my book, which are also very hard emotionally to write, I approach it the same way, where I feel like, you know, we know we're losing everything, and we are watching it happen before our very eyes. And all you have to do right now is pay attention and look out your window on a daily basis and see it with your own eyes wherever you are. And the fact that someone like me and a few other people are pulling all of this together and putting it in one place so that people can read it, I feel like I'm just documenting history so that, again, at the end of the day, you know, people, no one will be able to say, well, nobody told this was happening.
Hey, Dar, this is Pauline Schneider. How are you?
Hi, Pauline.
It's good to talk to you today. I have a couple questions. The first one has to do with the scientists that you were speaking with. I have a very good friend who does documentaries, and about 20 years ago, he was telling my then husband and me at dinner that his brother was a climate scientist up in the Arctic documenting our imminent extinction. That was 20 years ago. My question to you is, how long have the scientists that you met with been up there studying this?
Well, it's interesting. I interviewed not up in the Arctic, but Nate Stevenson. He's a forester with the U.S. Geological Survey down in Sequoia National Park. And that's been he's a Sierra, a fourth generation person from the Sierra Nevada, the Sierra Mountains. And, you know, I went out with him in the field earlier this summer, and it was again, another apocalyptic experience of being down in the high Sierra up around 6,000-7,000 feet. It's in the high 80s. There's wildfire smoke, pollution haze from the valley beneath us. Just a really amazing situation. And here we are amongst these 2,000 and 3,000-year-old trees that have survived everything. And yet, you know, we're looking at how much longer are these trees going to be around? And he said, you know, to address your question, he said, you know, I talked to him about, I was like, you know, look, we know what's happening here. You know, how do you keep doing your work personally, carrying all this information? And he says, well, I, in the early 90s, realized what was happening and that we'd already gone off the cliff, that, you know, Hansen went before Congress back in the early 80s and blew the whistle and sounded the alarm bells and, of course, was summarily ignored largely. And here I knew by the mid 90s that we were done and that we were going off the cliff and probably already were off the cliff. And so I went through my grieving process then. He said, I went through the depression and the anger and the rage, and then and now I just keep doing my work. And I think much like for the reasons that I gave, that, you know, he loves science, he loves the trees, he loves the Sierra, and he's just gonna keep doing his work. But he too went through his own grieving process, but he did so back in the early 90s.
Yes. Well, that of course. And even before, you know, James Hansen, we had, you know, the National Geographic episodes and Jacques Cousteau warning us. You know, this isn't news to
and Svante Arrhenius back to 1896 with the first Refereed Journal article on the topic. And before him, George Perkins Marsh. And the list goes on. Sir Tyndall in England.
Yeah, I think there's a culture in this country of ignoring the scientists, you know, those elitist scientists. How dare they have education and tell, you know, the unwashed what is what. But you mentioned about, you know, how do you deal, you know, people going through the grief once they realize what's really happening. And you know, we all have gone through our grieving processes, and, you know, we're always told, you know, how do you do this every day without getting depressed, and why do you tell people this? It's just going to make people depressed and want to commit suicide. And, you know, what's really interesting is, yeah, I think depression is a normal response to discovering your world's going away. I don't think there's anything wrong with being really sad and really depressed. I also think there's nothing wrong with acting and going through your depression. And, you know, I hear you have a beautiful garden, Dar, and I hear that from someone who is sitting right next to us here. Our thoughtful wanderer has fallen in love with gardening thanks to you, Dar. And, you know, so many gardeners in the world have discovered this connection to Earth. And at the end of times now, what do you make of that? You know, here we are putting our hands in the earth as she's dying, and now we're falling in love with her. Almost an afterthought.
Well, I mean, you putting it that way, I think, really sums it up. I mean, if I'm given my last my choice of what my last moment is going to look like, I hope it's being pressed up against the planet in some way like that, you know, or at least in a place that I love and care about. I can't imagine a better way to go. But yeah, it's funny that Paul is there after having been down here not too long, or up here not too long ago, and takes better care of my place than I do.
That's what he says too.
Sorry, what's that?
That's what he says too.
Oh yeah,
just kidding.
But it's, you know, it's you, one point that you bring up that I want to tease out a little bit is that, you know, the culture in the United States is so utterly sick and spiritually bankrupt at this point that, you know, it, God forbid if anybody expresses emotions, right? Emotionality has been completely pathologized, let alone expressing emotions for the very planet that we live on and that sustains us. I mean, it's, let alone we would feel sad because a part of the planet that you love just went up in smoke in a wildfire, or that a coral reef that you grew up with your whole life is dying before your very eyes, or a glacier that you have climbed on and is beautiful is completely melted into oblivion before your very eyes. God forbid anybody feel emotions around that, and let alone express them publicly, either writing about it or in a TV or radio interview. I mean, it's laughable, right? And I think that putting it that way, how insane and sick is it to not have strong feelings about what's happening? That instead we're supposed to just check our humanity at the door and just, you know, believe certain scientists that refuse to talk about you know, the reality of the situation. And so it's important, I think, for all of us to be very honest about our assessment of what's happening. And when people call me out, oh, you're so apocalyptic and your dispatches and such, it's just too doom and gloom. And that happens to me. And then I've had people personally in a couple of different situations come up and say, you need to report more good news, this kind of thing. And, you know, my response to that is this, and it's, you know, first of all, let's be adult. Can we all just be adults here and look honestly about what's happening and deal with the responsibilities that come with that? And then the other thing is, for example, if you're planning a backpacking trip or a climb and it requires maps and going into the backcountry, I feel like my information is giving people as accurate a map as I can give them to navigate this period of history and to determine, okay, this is what's happening on the planet now. What do I want to do with my time? And so do you not want the most accurate map possible if you're planning for a trip like that? And I just leave that as an open question.
Yeah, that's a great way to respond to that issue. We are taking your calls. Dial us up toll-free at 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Benji from Berkeley. Benji, are you with us?
I am. You know, the shit is now hitting the fan, but I've already got me a plan. It's simple advice, yet fairly precise. Stay fucked up as much as you can.
Dar, I'd love your response to that.
Well, I guess that's one way to go about it.
That's right. And, you know, there are 7.5 billion ways to deal with this information. I try not to tell people what to do, although I'm frequently asked, how should I respond to this information? What am I supposed to do with this knowledge now that you've dumped it on me? How do you answer that question other than the open question that you leave people with? When somebody comes up and says, you have to tell us everything, how do you respond?
Well, I've learned through hard lessons not to tell anybody what to do about anything, you know, that we're all completely autonomous, responsible people. Well, not already responsible, but people that we need to be responsible for ourselves. And you know, I would say, well, you can ask me what I do, and here's what I do, and I can share the various things I do to kind of maintain a center and some sort of equilibrium and how I want to spend my time, you know? And so I share that, which is what we've already discussed, spending as much time in nature as possible. I'm out in it every day because I live in the woods, and then I go deeper out into it every weekend. And then also being very, very discerning about who I spend my time with, knowing that, you know, we don't know how much longer a system's going to be in place that there's even functional air travel, or, you know, how much longer does the economic system hold together, et cetera. What happens with North Korea? I mean, our time in so many different ways, it's clear that we do not have an infinite amount of time. And so who do I want to spend that time with? And then what do I want to spend that time doing? You know, that there's just not a lot of time to screw off, you know, to put it another way. So I just share, you know, if they really want to know. But you know, the other thing too is I've just given up largely talking about it, and I just don't bring it up, only with certain people that I know understand what's happening and want to talk about it. Because most people, certainly in the United States today, even on the so-called left, just don't want to hear about it. You know, they want to know, well, when's the next solution book coming out about it? Oh, have you read Paul Hawkins' book Drawdown? And, you know, all this stuff that Guy, I've heard you refer to brilliantly as hopium. And they don't want to know. And so I'm very careful about, you know, even entering into conversation with people about the state of things.
Right. So you brought up relationships. And you indicated that you don't really talk about this with people unless they make some effort and indicate they want to know. So I assume there have been some relationships that have been altered along the way. Are you willing to tell us about that, or is that getting a little too personal, in which case we'll take a call?
No, it's, well, we can do both. I mean, I'll be short about it. It's fine. There's certainly been several friendships that I've lost, that literally just, you know, people just don't want to know about it. And so we just simply stop hanging out. You know, I guess it's almost akin to finding, like, oh yeah, we were great friends and we were, you know, having these good backpacking trips or whatever. And then I found out they're a Republican or something, you know. It's like, well, that's just not going to really work out because I'm not a fascist. So we're probably not going to continue to get along. So it's kind of like that, where this is a big enough issue for me. I mean, I live, eat and breathe doing this research and tracking what's happening to the planet. And so if you hang out with me, we're going to talk about this. And so if you don't want to talk about this stuff, then, you know, you're probably going to be better suited hanging out with somebody, not me. So that's been my experience with more than one person that I was friends with. And it's not like it ended on a bad note. We just basically stopped spending time together because they didn't want the information.
Right.
Guy and I have no idea what that feels like.
Yeah, right.
We can't relate at all.
No.
Yeah, I appreciate your stunningly subtle response there. We have Peter from Knoxville. Are you still with us, Peter from Knoxville? Do you have a question for Dar or for me?
Well, just hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hey, Peter.
Oh, good. Can you hear Harvey in the background?
Is that who Harvey I heard? I couldn't tell if that was Harvey or Irma.
No, that is Harvey hovering over Knoxville now. But I did want to ask you guys your thoughts on now it's Harvey, Irma, and then there's Lydia and Jose. Did you hear about that? Yeah. There's four of them out there.
Oh, yeah. But it's almost as if we're experiencing real storms now.
Well, I'm kind of excited. You were talking about depression and stuff. And, you know, I went through this when I discovered all of these about 3 years ago. But so now it seems to be kind of happening. And I can only be honest, I'm kind of excited about it. I mean, I don't know what stage I'm in. But also, you know, I went through, like, personal depression earlier in life, and I didn't want to do that. So maybe that my reaction was to, I went through all these websites and YouTube videos to try to find out, oh, it couldn't be real. So you guys ended up teaching me a lot about science, and these guys that, like, you know, the deniers and just people that don't think that the end is near, they're just very strange. They start talking about sunspots and things like this. But I just want to congratulate you guys because you made science utterly comprehensible to the C student.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. We appreciate it. Dar, do you want to comment? I know you only have about 3 minutes left with us. So if you can comment on that, and then we'll wrap with a little mini conversation about the end of ice.
Yeah, I think it's important that, you know, I mean, it's one positive thing about the apocalypse that we are experiencing is that, you know, it has brought a basic scientific understanding to the fore in the general population. I mean, most, you know, the most current polls I've seen show that, you know, well over 60% of Americans feel that climate disruption is real and it's a big enough problem that the government needs to do something about it, et cetera, et cetera. And understand the basics, you know, it's basic high school physics to talk about what happens when you put too much of a heat-trapping greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. It warms things up, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's been a positive aspect of it as well. And then also just to highlight the nefariousness of the fossil fuel-funded denialist movement. I think that, you know, most, again, you know, the average person in the country and the vast majority of people understand that anyone that doesn't believe climate disruption at this point is kind of beyond trying to convince at this point.
Yeah, the words paid and crazy come to mind. can you give us, in the very short time you have remaining, can you give us a 1 minute sketch, the trailer for your forthcoming book, The End of Ice, which is due out next year?
It's a very personal first-person account of going out into these different parts of the planet that are absolutely amazing. So it's really even more of a first-person nature narrative of the amazingness in certain places, as well as then a very personal, visceral, emotional at times narrative about the dramatic changes that I've personally witnessed in some of these places that I do have long-term relationships, like Denali in Alaska and the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and some other places, and then bringing in the hard science on the back of that, whether it's from my research or direct first-person interviews with a lot of the leading scientists on these issues. So it's going to be very focused on really, let's appreciate how amazing this planet really is right now, you know, to really try to bring that to the fore. It's not an activist book. It's not a book about let's change this, let's mitigate this, write your congressperson. It's none of that stuff. It's just a very real assessment on where we are, what's happening to the planet, and a very honest approach at that, as well as, I think, an adult approach. And one that my only goal of the book is that people will finish reading it and put it down and then just want to go out and be on the part of the planet that's the most important to them.
That sounds great. It was late 1950s and early 1960s when somebody else was doing the same thing, a renowned scientist working for the federal government in that case. Rachel Carson published Silent Screen and Silent Spring in 1962. But she was doing much the same thing. It was a series of personal stories that became her books, and she was very much an artist cloaked in a scientific arena, a scientific discipline. So you have some precedence. Perhaps in another 65 years, people will be reading, oh, wait. We look forward to The End of Ice in 2018 from our guest, Darjamail. You can stay abreast of Dar's outstanding work at darjamail.net. Thanks very much for joining us today, Dar. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Guy, and thanks all the rest of you. Good to talk with you, and be well out there.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Thanks, Dar.
And Dar's name is spelled DARJAMAIL.net for our listeners.
Darjamail.net. Great, great radical revolutionary journalist who has sacrificed so much in the pursuit of the truth. He moved to Alaska after he got his undergraduate degree and at Texas A&M University. And he wasn't there long before he realized that politics were hugely important and the war machine in the United States was something worth reporting on. So he just threw away every aspect of his life that he loved, living outdoors in Alaska, and moved to the Middle East to report on the military misadventures of the United States and crowd there. So, again, thanks to Dar. And again, we're taking your calls. You can dial us up toll free at 888-874-4888.
You know, Guy, I was just thinking, you know, Dar is gone now, but I thought, you know, it would have been kind of fun to ask him if maybe one of his next projects could be a sort of a comedy news show on Comedy Central, you know, where he does a mock-you news episode of climate change and extinction and war. And I don't think anyone's done that yet, have they?
No, I don't think that would appear on any mainstream television show.
No. But why not?
Because we don't joke about this.
Oh, that's true. We just make up news.
Because this is the last show, and therefore it's a celebration of sorts. I'm here with friends. Part of the celebration is going to be me telling you how wonderful I am. If you didn't know that already, because you're a regular listener.
It's not the last show.
No, that's not what I said. I said it's my last show as the host.
Okay.
And it's the only time, in all likelihood, the five of us are going to get together to have this celebration.
That's true. That's very true.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to read an email message I received yesterday from Australia. Dear Professor McPherson, my name is Susan McKillicuddy, and I'm a lecturer at a university in Australia. I just wanted to offer you my sincere thanks across the miles for your courage, honesty, and calm sincerity in the face of our imminent end as a species. I have been observing the effects of climate change since the 80s, and have been stunned by the increase in recent years of evidence that we were well past any possible turning point. Whenever I try to discuss this with students, colleagues, or friends, I am amazed at how quickly they seem to flick their denial switch after acknowledging that this is actually happening. It's beautiful in a way, too, because that denial will enable those of us who live in a state of privileged oblivion to carry on regardless until the you-know-what hits the fan. My own prediction is that we have 4 years left, tops. She's talking about as a species here. And like you, I still brush and floss, and am focusing what is left on appreciating beauty, being productive, and endeavoring in all ways to be kind and loving to others. I also allow myself to enjoy my favorite music, books, and films and hobbies. I'm also trying to dance and sing every day. It can be very lonely at times being so acutely aware of what's happening and speeding up on a daily basis when others don't want to hear it. But then there's really no point in that either, is there? Being lonely, I mean. When that happens, I step out onto my balcony on a balmy night like tonight and watch the full moon sparkle on the Pacific Ocean in front of me. And I crank up the damn stereo and go, woohoo. It just means a lot, and it's so very comforting to know that you're out there calmly telling us the truth with your dignity and whimsical sense of humor. With an extra U in humor, I might add. Thank you so much, and oceans of love to you from the Southern Hemisphere. Warm regards, Susan. So thank you, Susan, for that wonderful and timely message in very light nice. Of what's going on in my personal life. We have a caller, Anne from Syracuse. Are you still with us? And will you say something to indicate as much?
Yes, I'm here, Guy. Hi, Guy, and hi, Pauline, and hello, guests.
Hi, Anne.
Hi, Anne.
I just wanted to call. I've been so grateful for many, many months and years now for Guy's perspective and information. And for me right now, as the end draws near, I feel it every every time I look at the internet and see a new outrageous headline, every morning I wake up, I think, oh, another day. Isn't that nice? What should I do with it? I'm pouring chocolate right now into a mold that I made myself, and we'll see how that turns out. So I'm sort of, I don't know if regressing is right or progressing into my childhood state as much as possible, because I'm fluctuating between, you know, how can it possibly have more outrage as on top of the pile that I know of what our species has done to ourselves and this planet. And yet the outrage upon outrage is heaped and heaped and heaped. And I don't know whether to laugh or, you know, immolate myself in front of the White House. And on the other,
on the other,
yeah.
You'd probably be side, arrested for that.
It seems like then pouring chocolate is the most sensible thing I can do, and giving the mold to my neighbor, or, you know, sharing that deliciousness for this moment, for this infinitely finite period of time. So that's my perspective today, but I am missing you, Guy, on Facebook and various places, but I totally respect and applaud your actions, and I really hope you take care of yourself. I love you a lot.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much. We have a message as kid just from a dear friend of ours.
Hi. So our good friend Cameron Kelly in New York, who actually introduced Guy and me, it's her fault that we know each other.
I'm sure there's plenty of blame to go around.
So she just sent me this wonderful text about Silent Spring. And she writes, Silent Spring was the inspiration for Fidel Castro. In fact, they met to make the Cuban Revolution also a revolution to respect nature and the environment. The coral reefs around Cuba are pristine. No pesticides are allowed to be used in any Cuban cities. All vegetable agriculture is organic, and it goes on and on. And they don't have the bee colony collapse that we do in the U.S. So thank you, Cameron, so much for sharing this.
And thank you for our callers for sharing as well. It's great to have this, what was always designed as the people's radio. It's great to have people calling in and perhaps for the final time saying our goodbyes. Again, we're taking your calls. Toll-free number is 888-874-4888.
Well, speaking of our final goodbyes, I mean, not just on the radio, we're planning to go to New York on September 11th. And
how smart does that sound?
I don't think we're very smart. I thought it would be very clever of us, you know, but we've got some interesting things happening at the same time. We've got Irma coming in and
Jose batting cleanup right behind Irma.
Right behind. And then there's, you know, the potential for false flag events.
Sure. I mean, Saturday, the 9th of September, is North Korea's National Founding Day. So if you wanted to make it look like North Korea did something, what better time than that? Or Patriot Day on September 11th.
Right.
We'd only have to keep the one holiday.
Yeah, well, our plane is supposed to connect in Miami, and I don't know if Miami will still
Atlanta.
Be there.
Atlanta.
Sarah and I argued about this half a day today, where our flight is landing. We're flying with Sarah, and if you're going to Miami and Sarah's going to Atlanta, I'm going to have a tough decision to make.
You're going to have to, like, straddle two
Which
planes.
One of these women am I going to go with?
We'll just have to flip a coin.
I don't like the sound of that.
And I'm stuck with going through Houston, so who knows what
at least
that
you
looks
were
like.
Coin flipped into a plane.
That's a good point. You have a good point there, Doctor.
And are you leaving the same day?
Same day.
Okay, so we've got so four of us are, you know, going to be flying on September 11th. I don't know
totally
if that's a good
screwed.
What were we thinking?
Sounds not so swift after all.
I think I'll be walking.
You'll be walking.
Yes. Glenn will be walking. The rest of us will be sitting in an airport wishing we were flying.
Right. Oh,
exactly. Or perhaps not.
Or dead.
You know,
dead or Canadian.
You're all Canadian. and you're all gonna be dead. You know, your 3-day theory doesn't look so bad now, Paul Marcotte. Why don't you tell us, remind us again, your 3-day story about how you choose to live?
I guess I don't know how long it's been. I've been thinking about this probably for the last year, but I thought that, you know, 3 days, if I knew that I had 3 days, and of course I could have 3 seconds, but if I knew that I had 3 days, I think that's more than enough time to quote unquote get my affairs in order and tell the people that I love that I love them, and kind of go out, find a spot out in nature that I can, you know, watch the stars and call it a day. So if I get 3 days, that's great. But the way things are going, in light of what we just talked about, 3 days is probably a little bit optimistic at this point.
Well, we'll see. You know, it's like Louis C.K. says, you don't know when your time is up. You never really know. The best you can do is this is probably it.
That's right.
You know, and Edward Abbey thought this was it. He went out and laid in the sleeping bag in his backyard. And then it got dark, and then it got cold, and he says, hey, guys, this isn't it after all.
Exactly.
It took him weeks to die after that, yeah. So we never really know.
We don't know.
Well, we spend most of our existence dead, according to Louis C.K. I really like that.
Yeah.
You know.
We have a caller. I just saw it come across the screen. Bruce from Santa Barbara. Does that sound right? Bruce, yeah. Are you with us?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, we had an interesting weather event on Labor Day yesterday in Santa Barbara where something, the sky got dark and a tornado, they called it a microburst, and I didn't even know what that was. And so the sky got dark and a tornado knocked over a bunch of palm trees right near the beach, and then it cleared up again. So it just reminded me of your work and how suddenly these things can happen. And I'm wondering if you're planning on expanding the monster essay into a book, as kind of, I would think that would be a great last essay if you add in the humorous aspects, it could be expanded into a great book. I'd love to read it if you choose to do that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We'll see. We'll see how much time we have. We'll see if we get through this September before I make any real commitments.
Let's get through the weekend.
we have this 3-day thing going on now.
Oh, yeah.
But right. It's a great idea.
It is a great idea.
And it's something that we have talked about in the past.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Thank you for the call, Bruce. You. And we have Brenda from Texas. Brenda, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking the call. I'm from your sister city in Texas, San Antonio. And I wanted to say first, it's good to hear you guys having a fun time. And also wanted to thank you for your work, your courage, your integrity. And because of becoming aware of the information you've provided, it did change some things for me and my husband and our life. And of all things, for what it's worth, a few months back, I came to this conclusion that if nothing else, we should try to figure out how to, as we're going out, be in a state of consciousness that offers up something that isn't a matter of, you know, just trying to kill whoever's next to you and screaming with your hair on fire. So what I've just learned within the past month, I've been going to attending Quaker meetings, which I never would have imagined I would have done such a thing. I have considered myself atheist, agnostic, you know, not interested, recovering with no hope of relapse. At any rate, something about this connected a dot for me, and I learned at their annual gathering, there is a Quaker scholar who is working quickly to try and create a contemplative community whose sole aim is toward creating what she kept referring to as a remnant to be able to send out into the cosmos to represent something, I guess you'd say, you know, just plain good about all of us rather than sinking into, you know, whatever the goo is going to be screaming. So, anyway, you've I think you've raised awareness. I think you've created something important. And I just, again, express my appreciation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that, Brenda. And I know we have two more callers on the line, but we're out of time. So sorry to Sandy and Hugh, both from New York, but we need to wrap the show within the next minute and a half. So here we go.
Well, Guy's going to be in New York from the 11th to the 20th very quickly. Just so you know, if you want to get in touch with him, you know how to message him, you know how to email him or contact me.
All my contact information is at the blog, guymcpherson.com. So you can email me from there if you want to get together with me when I'm in New York in a week or so. Thanks to our listeners and callers today. You can catch NBL on PRN the first Tuesday afternoon of each month at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The next show marks Kevin Hester's premiere as host, and it will broadcast live on Tuesday afternoon, the 3rd of October. If you missed the live broadcast, you can find shows in the archives at PRN, the Podbean, at Stitcher, and feel free to rate the show on iTunes. Also continue to follow the Nature Bats Last blog, guymcpherson.com, for further updates, interviews, and speaking tours. You can keep current with Kevin Hester's work at kevinhester.live. Thanks again to today's guests, all of them, listeners, all of them, and also to AfroZen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, all together now,
Nature Bats Last.
Yeah, we took our turn and we trashed the place, turning rivers to sewers and forests to oceans of waste. But what goes around must come around, and what goes up has gotta come down, and the higher the peak, the farther the fall to the ground. It was good while it lasted, but this good thing has come to an end. This is the end.
The reason I call it die-off is because I see a really horrible future coming. It's not one that I want.
It was good while it lasted, but this good thing has come to an end. It was